This conversation between Dr. Robert John and Brenda Dunn, the principal authors of Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research, was recorded on February 2, 2005.
From the earliest conception of this program, through its early design and implementation, and its subsequent many years of laboratory and theoretical operations, the interpersonal dynamic between our laboratory manager, Brenda, and myself as director of the program have been absolutely central to its progress. Whether you speak of the professional complementarity of our approaches to the topic or the personal take that we have had on its findings, on its people, on its implications. I think what has distinguished our work from that of virtually any other laboratory has been this complementarity of perspectives. My own background, of course, has been that of an applied scientist, an engineer, and my role has been primarily to maintain the technical sophistication and rigor of the experimental efforts and the astuteness of the attempts to represent them theoretically in terms that will be useful, indeed digestible, to the high science and technology communities. Brenda's background and natural disposition has been from quite another quarter, as she will herself describe. But as we've gone forward, the give and take between these two quite dissimilar but highly complementary perspectives has been a very essential feature, and we're going to talk about that for a bit here.
Well, as Bob mentioned, his approach has been much more of a focus on the technical operations, the administration. Mine has been more on the interpersonal. I've seen my role primarily as an integrator, somebody who could pull together the different perspectives that came from the many different backgrounds of our staff members, the physicists, the biologists, the psychologists, many of whom speak different languages and whose points of view aren't always apparently compatible. I also feel that it's been an essential part of my role to create an atmosphere, an ambiance for our operators, to make the lab a homey, comfortable place where people feel at ease, where they don't feel that they're lab rats under a microscope as subjects of a study, but as participants, collaborators, and contributors to the research in a very personal way.
One understanding we acquired quite early in this program, actually, was that it is possible to fail in such an endeavor on either sides of a rather narrow crest of the intellectual hillside. On the one hand, one needs to have very solid scientific technique undergirding the experimental and theoretical programs in order that whatever data, whatever results are acquired, will be credible in the eyes of the science and technology communities, among others. But on the other hand, we have learned that it's also possible to sterilize the program in terms of excessive rigor to the point where the phenomena themselves are suffocated and simply do not appear. And so the overarching challenge to establish a research program that can, on the one hand, provide a happy home for these effects to surface within an analytical framework, but on the other hand, to make sure that the analysis of those data. Indeed, the acquisition of those data are beyond question, is really the delicate balancing act that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
We had a very striking example of that in our analyses of the remote perception data that we accumulated over the years. As we've mentioned elsewhere, the main purpose of the program in remote perception was not so much to demonstrate whether or not the phenomenon existed, but really to try to develop some kind of quantitative methods whereby we could measure, we could demonstrate analytically the amount of information that was being acquired in this anomalous manner. And early on, when we started, the experiment was fairly loose. Basically, people were asked to just free associate, try to imagine where the agent was going to be located at a agreed upon time, and tape record into a microphone or write or draw at length. They were encouraged to keep going for 10 or 15 minutes and just keep on rambling. We got some fairly lengthy transcripts out of these, but there were striking similarities between the percipients' descriptions and the agents' photographs or descriptions of the location itself. The original data were analyzed, were reduced by asking human judges to rank order these. How well do you think this target matches this perception, and so forth. And we would use those ranks as the basis of the quantification. But then we said this was kind of loose, it wasn't very effective, it wasn't very efficient, we needed to go to something more rigorous. And we developed this wonderful set of descriptors. It was a list of 30 yes-no questions. Is the scene indoors or outdoors? Is it noisy? Is it quiet? And we would ask the agent at the scene to answer these questions, and then the percipient, after generating the perception, would answer the same questions. And these responses became the basis for our quantification. Well, as time went on, we were hearing our participants say, you know, I feel very constrained by these questions. I feel that they're sort of forced into it. And we heard them, but we didn't hear them. We thought that the questions were just too rigid. So we went from binary yes, no to yes, no, maybe, or yes, no, I don't know. They still said they felt constrained. We went to a quaternary. Yes, this concept is definitely present. Yes, it's sort of present, but it's not important. I really don't know whether it's present or not. No, it's definitely not present. We thought this would do it, but it didn't seem to be enhancing the effect. In fact, if anything, the responses, the data results were getting weaker. And still, our operators were claiming that they were feeling constrained, and still, we were not hearing what they were actually saying. So we moved to the distributive method. On a scale of 0 to 9, how much of the scene is indoors? How noisy is it? How crowded is it? And by this time, we had tightened up our protocol. We had made sure that we responded to every criticism that had ever been raised about our procedures. And we had an airtight protocol with no feedback until after the experiment was finished, with replacement of targets, with controlled this and controlled that. And this broad distributive response option, and the results of some 150 trials done in that manner were absolutely zilch. There was nothing there. And we spent, what, 2-3 years after that trying to figure out what went wrong. We looked at it this way, that way. We looked at the different scoring methods. We looked at the raw data. And it took us a while until, looking at the raw data, we noticed something very obvious that we had not seen before. Namely, those 2- and 3-page descriptions had now been reduced to a check sheet, possibly with a word or two of emphasis. But people were no longer free responding. People were answering a forced choice questionnaire. And once they had seen that questionnaire, the next time they approached the task, They knew what the questions were going to be. They weren't attempting to perceive or interact or connect with the agent. They were attempting to get the right answers on this test. And it was really quite constrained. They were constrained. They were constrained by being forced to put their perceptions, their intuitive, dreamlike imagery through this sieve of forced formal questions and answer them in a defined way. And it totally suppressed the effects. It was a rude awakening. It was disappointing. We felt rather dumb when we realized how people had been trying to tell us about this sense of constraint, and we had been misinterpreting the meaning of this. But we did learn something very important. In the last year or two, we've actually gone back to the original protocol, done a few trials with just the free response, and lo and behold, the phenomenon reemerges. There it is. But what we learned was you put it through the sieve after you have the data in hand. You don't put the sieve up front before you generate it. This is the sort of dialogue that I think Bob was describing. This balance between getting a rigorous and quantitative and carefully designed protocol and leaving room for this flow from the unconscious, from the source, if you will, to come through unimpeded into awareness of the participants.
We've encountered what I believe to be a rather similar effect in our human-machine experiments. So long as we had posed for the operators a relatively simple task, shift the mean of the REG's distribution to the right or to the left, the high or low values, we would get good results. But then we got more complicated. We got more greedy, if you like, and began imposing experimental protocols on both the operators and the machines, actually. They got more and more multivariate. We'd say, well, let's check whether it makes any difference how rapidly you accumulate the trial scores, or let's check whether there's a difference between a random source and a pseudo-random source. Let's check whether it makes any difference that you change this or you change that. And we'd set up complex experiments where there'd be half a dozen different experimental variables riding on the program. And then after collection of the data, we would try to disentangle them so we could say, yeah, this is an important factor, that's not an important factor. Well, in the abstract, this might seem like a good idea, but in point of fact, confronted with this complexity of experiment, once again, the phenomena seemed to go out to lunch, just refused to play by those rules. Whether it was a confound in the psyche of the operators or whether it was more fundamentally based in the nature of the information alterations themselves, the fact remains the big primary effects began to subside, and in their place we were picking up a lot of microstructure, a lot of internal structure in the databases that in its own way was just as anomalous as the original intentional data were, but certainly were not conforming to the original intentions. And indeed, it was this additional reinforcement that these effects were not playing by the usual rules of scientific experimentation that drove a number of the theoretical models that we subsequently attempted to construct. Most notably, I think, the M5 model, wherein we take the big step of saying, look, this is not really an interaction going on between the conscious mind of the operator and the physical processes of the machine as we specify them. Rather, it's more complicated than that, making use on the one hand of the unconscious mentation of the human operators and on the other side of the street on what the physical scientists would refer to as an intangible or an ontic set of events going on well below the surface of the tangible, of the observable physical effects. That recognition that when one is dealing with phenomena that are buried in the subconscious rather than floating on the conscious, not only predicated some radical models, but also some major changes in our experimental procedures.
All of the effects that we were seeing have always been so tiny that it required very large databases, many, many replications before we could get out of the statistical noise and get a robust enough effect to trade on. And so it was always this temptation to answer more questions than one in the interests of efficiency instead of one question every 5 years. And of course, the more one did this and the more one complicated it, as you say, it the effects got weaker and more diffuse as the questions became weaker and more diffuse. Another thing that we took us a while to notice was that we were seeing bigger effects here and there. One of them was in the remote human-machine experiments. And what was very striking was that those remote experiments, although the statistical leverage was weaker because the databases were smaller, actually had slightly larger effect sizes. When you went to the off time, the effect sizes got even bigger. It was almost as if the more impossible you made the task, the more clearly this anomalous channel would send its information through. Each time you made the task a little more impossible from a logical cognitive standpoint, you almost shorted out those conscious filters, if you will. And there it was once again. Somehow or other, having stated the intention clearly and specifically, one then had to shut up and get out of the way and listen for the answer. We've seen this throughout history in the oracles, the I Ching, so many different types of anomalous information acquisition. You know, people were advised, ask a clear question. And then the information would come back, the Delphic Oracle would come back with the sort of vague, if you will, free response transcript that had to be interpreted. The Sibyl was not given a list of yes-no questions. Nor was the inquirer coming to the Sibyl and saying, shall I invade Mesopotamia? And by the way, if I do, should I use camels or elephants? And if I use the elephants, how many should I bring? You know, the questions had to be clear. They had to be simple. The answers would come back with a high degree of uncertainty riding on them. And somehow or other, one had to sort through that to find the information one was looking for. There are certain similarities in this. Keep the questions simple. Don't try to complicate your protocols. Ask a simple question. Ask it carefully. Don't get tempted to go off course. And make sure you've got enough data that allows you to get through the noise and at the answer that's there. And don't expect clear yes-no answers. These are probabilistic issues. They're probabilistic processes. All we can hope for is to tilt the probabilities in one direction or another. You don't get a yes or a no. If you can go from 50-50 to 55-45 in your odds for a response, you've done well.
Brenda has mentioned a very important word and a very important concept in what she just said. The word was uncertainty. In virtually all scientific research, there is an effort made to reduce the uncertainty of the situation as far as possible, to come up with the most precise result, to come up with the most deterministic output so that one can be confident of the particular result you have gotten. When you want to manufacture pharmaceuticals, you want very little uncertainty in the quality of that product. When you build a high-performance aircraft, you really don't want a lot of uncertainty in the operation of the systems and subsystems of that technology. But in this business, the reverse almost seems to be the case, that as we continue to strive to reduce uncertainty, we are also somehow obstructing the emergence of the phenomenon of cells, almost as if the uncertainty implicit in the situation serves as the raw material out of which is constructed a new reality, out of which is constructed a result that is anomalous that is not the one you would get from the highly precise, highly certain situation. It is one that has left room for whatever the source of these effects are to express itself. And indeed, we have seen over and over again that the intrinsic uncertainty in the device, in the protocol, in the interpretation is somehow an important ingredient in the appearance of the effects themselves. Now, in all these vignettes we've just been talking about, we could come back to the original statement. All of it benefits so much from a complementarity of perspectives that on the one hand can keep your eye on the cat of rigor and analytical precision and defensibility of the results, but at the same time could keep an open channel for the phenomena themselves to appear. And it's in that context that this interdisciplinarity of the backgrounds, of the natural strengths, of the perspectives of Brenda and myself that have been so valuable, so productive. I sort of wander around the place keeping an eye that the results are sufficiently precise that one can build interpretations on them. Brenda's role has been more slanted toward being sure that we kept the door open for the effects to come by in the first place. And this has not stopped, incidentally, with just the two of us. If you look at the backgrounds, the credentials, the personalities, the perspectives of the other members of our staff, you'll see there that they, too, fill out an even broader pattern of multidisciplinary, multi-attitudinal approaches to this topic that in their own way have contributed further to the productivity of the program. And out of this comes a much more floribundant understanding and grasp of what these phenomena are. And it doesn't even stop with our permanent staff people. We have, as we have said, a host of visitors of various ranks and statures, ranging from paragons of science and industry down to young people looking for stimulation in this topic and everything in between. But each of them brings in another perspective. If there is another important characteristic of such an endeavor as this one, it is that it has to be all things to all people. It is dealing with such a basic human capacity, such a basic interaction of the mortal mind with the cosmos, that you have to acquire perspectives from many different dimensions, many different interests. You're not going to get there simply going gung-ho down one particular path of study.
Well, consciousness itself is that which creates these distinctions. We have to remember that. There isn't a separate universe of physics, a separate universe of biology, a separate universe of philosophy. There's a universe. We experience that universe, and it is our consciousness, our intention. I want to be a physicist. I want to be a psychologist. I want to be an ecologist. That encourage us to turn and focus our perceptions on certain aspects of our experience and not on others. We filter. We filter out the world in accordance with what we are looking for. Einstein's wonderful statement of the theory determines what you can observe. Well, your intentions determine what you can observe, your expectations, your desires. And so if you're going to study the phenomenon, the actual source of these filters, of these perceptions, of these interpretations, you can't study that within one single filter. You have to be able to step back and see how these filters change and alter the point of view. On good days, when it works well, where all of these different points of view from different members of our staff would come together, and each person would bring their own strength and their own perspective to bear on a problem, and it would be solved, in, you know, miraculously. It would be magnificent to watch. Other times, people would be tripping over each other because they were intent on defending their point of view as the right one, intent on saying, well, this is more important than that. Well, we have to focus more on the analysis. Let's not waste our time with this soft, intuitive business. And we have our prejudices. But in terms of the way we look at the world, the expectations we have of it, these are pretty deep set. And it is also very clear that those filters are what we have to get out of the way if we're going to allow this source, this pure experience, to flow through. And like I was saying with the remote perception, we have to know where to apply the filters in the process. If you apply those filters too early on, you're not going to find what you're looking for. So the study of consciousness and its role in the establishment of reality has a lot to do with how and where we place those filters, and becoming aware of their existence and their centrality in defining human experience. We take an awful lot of that for granted. We're trained in it from the time we're tiny kids, and those things become just automatic. We don't think about them anymore. And yet they bias, they tilt, they distort our direct experience in very significant ways. So in many respects, having this complementary approach in learning, even just in our own interpersonal dialogue over the years, to recognize, to appreciate the other's way of looking at the world. Obviously, there are times when it's led to perhaps less than felicitous complementarity, one occasionally gets destructive interference as well. But by and large, it's been incredibly productive, not only in terms of the evolution of our program, but really in terms of our evolution as human beings. We have both grown immensely from understanding and respecting the point of view and the style and the worldview of the other.
All of the matters Brenda's just reviewed, and indeed the earlier points we've raised, would not have worked out nearly so well were it not for one other quality that has pervaded our professional and personal relationship. And that quality, of course, is resonance. In the absence of some genuine emotional resonance between the two of us, the disparities of style and background would have become very obstreperous. They would have obstructed rather than facilitated the work. But because we were able to bring them forward into this complementarity of perspective, riding on a genuine resonance between the two of us, we were able to derive the positive rather than the negative consequences of those disparities. This, again, is sort of a local demonstration of a much more endemic aspect of these phenomena that we have been able to uncover in the research program itself, namely the role of resonance in facilitating the effects. On the one hand, we have had a long history of anecdotal reports from our operators, and indeed from our own experience, that the most successful experiments seem to devolve from those cases where the operator and the device, or the percipient and the agent in the remote perception studies, have some sense of bond, some sense of resonance, some self-sacrificial surrender of individual identity and purpose in favor of the bonded system, whether it be an operator or an REG or a percipient on a target. When you could establish that resonance, things worked better.
When you think about the term resonance, I think one of the common phrases that comes to mind is being on the same wavelength. And in both a physical and in a metaphorical sense, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
A shared vision, a shared intention that guides the disposition of those different strategies or styles toward a common goal.
Right. And well beyond those anecdotal evidences, we have in one of our major programs, namely the Field Ring program, demonstrated not only the relevance of resonance, but the essential primacy of it in certain other contexts. As we have described elsewhere, what we're dealing with here are the deployment of small portable random event generator units as monitors of a variety of cultural group venues. We can put these devices unobtrusively in a business meeting, in an opera performance, in an athletic contest, in a church ceremony, in a medical diagnosis environment.
Meditation groups,
long list of venues in which a group of people are engaged in some purposeful task, whether it's planning a new business venture or attempting a surgical procedure or carrying out a great operatic performance, that there's some shared purpose. And what these results have shown quite clearly is that when those groups are, by this or any other term, resonant, that is to say, when people are, as Brenda says, on the same wavelength, have the shared enthusiasm, have some common goal that is expressing itself in a unanimity of strategy and effort going forward. In those cases, these little REGs produce outputs which, by the criteria we apply to them in this application, hugely exceed any chance expectations of what they should do. And yet these same boxes, deployed with the same protocols, in group environments where the resonance is not there, where the meeting is chaotic or boring or dull or somehow not purposeful, these same boxes return outputs that are far lower than chance expectation. The boxes literally go to sleep in terms of responding to this environment. The field reg title we apply to these studies is really a double entendre. On the one hand, we are deploying our experiment into the field. On the other hand, the boxes are somehow sensing a field of resonance, a field of purpose, a field of shared information at some level, and is saying, I know this, I want to get into this act, here is an output that reflects that. All of which is just to circle back and say that the characteristics of the people that manage this program are not incidental to the program. They reflect the essence of the fundamental processes that we are studying. And the role of resonance now must get elevated to a comparable stature with the role of intention, of desire, of purpose in the stimulation of these things. And the place to look for these effects is in an environment that encourages that sort of resonance in the task.
People frequently ask us, well, you know, if these effects are non-local and atemporal, then, you know, how do you know who is affecting the machine? How do you know what you're picking up in the remote perception? Because you could be getting anyone, any place, any time, or anybody out there in the world at any time thinking about the REG could be having an effect. How do you account for this? Well, I think the answer to that is the resonance factor. The person who is closer to the machine in the sense of a close friend, in the sense of a close exchange, emotionally speaking, subjectively speaking, seems to be the determining factor. That emotional closeness seems to somehow enhance the intentionality component of it.
I'm sure you recognize in Brenda's rendition a specific case of a generally accepted piece of evidence. The mother that becomes aware that her daughter is giving birth, the identical twin that picks up on the accident to the sibling, whatnot, these, again, anecdotal demonstrations of long-distance communication clearly travels on emotional channels, clearly travels on the channels of relevant resonance rather than going off to some other irrelevant participant.
And again, those things typically come in on an unconscious channel. They're not things that you're thinking about, but they come in maybe in a dream, maybe in a just this daydreaming state where you're not thinking.
Yes.
But if you sit and think about how is my son doing or how is my brother doing, you don't get as clear a signal.
So you might reasonably ask, okay, what's new? We've had these anecdotal experiences throughout history. What's new happening here? And obviously the distinction is here we have a demonstration that's going on, as it were, on the laboratory bench and is coming out with well-defined statistical objective data. And in fact, if we now had to reach into all of this pattern of understanding, what comes back out is the essence of these effects are that subjective properties are expressing themselves in objectively demonstrable results. And that is new. But as you look at the pattern of results, we find it doesn't matter how far the operator is from the machine. That's an objective parameter. I could have specified it as 1,350 miles. It doesn't matter that it was done in real time or done an hour and a half later or earlier. That's an objective quantity. It doesn't matter whether it's done on a little microelectronic processor or on the big pinball machine. That's an objective distinction. Over and over again, we find that the objective correlates aren't all that important. Where are the correlations? The correlations are with intention, with desire, with resonance, with value, with love. All of these soft coordinates are now the ones that are determining what comes out on your data stream. And that's a new ingredient. It is foreign to conventional science, or at least to contemporary conventional science. Let's talk about that for just a moment. This intrusion of subjective correlates into a scientific research effort raises major problems for contemporary scientific paradigms. Modern science, certainly modern physical science, does not routinely accept subjective correlates into its modeling, or indeed even into its expectations of physical effects. That was not always the case. Many centuries ago, in the days of the alchemists and the Hermetic scholars, it was much more generally accepted that subjective factors played an important role in the expression of physical phenomena. There were procedures for doing alchemical experiments that involved incantations or particular environments or whatever. Starting with the Age of the Enlightenment, as it's been called, the subjective factors, the emotional factors, have gradually been strained out of scientific methodology. Up until the end of the 19th century, that Renaissance science was totally mechanistic, deterministic, causal sort of logic, and a high principle was that you had to get the same answer if you did the same experiment, no matter who did it, and no matter in what attitude he did it or she did it, no matter where the experiment was performed. However, along about the end of the 19th century, that secular science had its cage rattled rather severely by a number of anomalous results that arose because of the improvement in technical instrumentation, primarily better spectrometers, better mass spectrographs, better telescopes, better microscopes, and so on, which yielded a rather startling array of anomalies, the wave-particle duality, the quantization of energy, the appearance of discrete spectral lines, and so on, and that in turn forced science to a major revision in its modeling, which we have come to call quantum science. A similar sort of thing occurred in a slightly different framework in terms of the replacement of Newtonian mechanics with relativistic mechanics. But in each case, great effort was expended in order to preserve a rigorous, deterministic, objective approach to reality. However, out of that came some unresolved paradoxes, the so-called observational effects, which by any other name still amounted to the intrusion of the consciousness of the experimenter into the results of the measurement. Still a matter of quarrel in the physical science communities today. So here with these anomalies of the sort we're talking about, where the subjective attitudes and desires and values and relationships of the human participants are manifesting themselves in the objectively specifiable output of the experiments, we have another challenge of the same magnitude, really, to conventional causal deterministic objective science that still prevails. Now, I will say that quite recently, there has been a subset of the physical science community that has begun to worry a bit more deliberately about how consciousness, how subjectivity might be included in the high science paradigms. They have pushed off from these quantum effects, from the subjective correlates of experiments like ours and others. And I think there's some progress being made. The parlance of this community is the distinction between exophysical models, that is to say, the old brand of classical scientific formalism, and endophysical phenomena, which somehow are those that are experienced by the individual consciousness.
What we've called the science of the subjective.
What they have not done very well so far is to acknowledge in these endophysical models that it is they themselves that are making the endophysical models. But it's exciting now to see an awareness growing, not only in the community of scholars of consciousness, not only in the psychological, neuropsychological communities where consciousness is now being addressed, albeit in a rather mechanistic, brain-oriented fashion, but also in the physical sciences and in a number of other perspectives. The philosophers are returning to these issues in ways that they had addressed previously a century or two ago, and I think we will see over the coming years an accommodation of subjectivity within a more generalized scientific representation of the world.
This image brings to mind yet another example of complementarity. Two fundamental processes of the human mind are the act of discrimination and the act of integration. We have emphasized in science over the last several centuries greater and greater and more precise discrimination, breaking things down into its parts, our whole reductionistic approach to understanding the world. We come down, you know, to the atom and the subatomic particle and the quarks and whatnot. And yet now there is this tendency to start seeing in the science of complexity, the science of entanglement, terms that indicate that there's a growing awareness of the fact that there is this other aspect of consciousness, this ability to recognize similarity. Again, back to the alchemists, the principle of similarity was again an important factor there. It's almost as if we are rediscovering some of these alchemical principles in the context of our modern world. But there, too, you have to have this this complementary relationship. One without the other doesn't work. You know, the beauty of complementarity is that it gets you out of the dualistic paradox. where you have to say everything is one, a monistic approach, and then you have to decide what that one is. Or there's two worlds, the Cartesian mind-matter dichotomy, and so forth. But when you start thinking in terms of complementarity, you're no longer saying it has to be either mind or matter, or it has to be either a wave or a particle. You now say it is both. It is that the wave and the particle, the mind and the matter, the objective and the subjective, are simply two different ways to look at a situation. One of my favorite images is the grapefruit universe. You know, if you have a grapefruit, you slice it one way and you open it up, you see this pattern of segments, this sort of sun ray with the center point and all the segments going this way. You slice that same grapefruit a different way and you're going to get a whole different pattern than emerges when you look at the opened hemisphere. Every grapefruit has the potential for both of these designs. Obviously, once you cut the grapefruit in half, you can't put it back together and cut it the other way fresh. And there you have the, I guess, the essence of the Schrödinger's cat paradox. But the mind makes a decision. I'm going to slice it this way, and I'm going to look at this particular pattern that emerges. But it is the mind. It is we who decide how we're going to look at it. And if we could go into this new science of the subjective with a conscious awareness that we are making that decision, we as scientists, we as human beings, have the responsibility for choosing how we are going to look at the world around us, and in so doing, create the world that we experience up to a point, then we can begin to incorporate this subjective domain into our objective recognition. What was Heisenberg's example? When one realizes one has the option of enjoying music or analyzing its structure, we have this choice to experience the world in a very subjective form, or to look at it, objectify it, describe it as precisely as we can. But we mustn't confuse, as the man said, the map with the territory. Our descriptions are still just maps. They are not reality per se. This is what I think contemporary science hasn't yet come to grips with. And well, this is where the subjectivity is. It comes into the game so strongly.
And this subjectivity, this science of the subjective, as we've titled it, comes bearing other complications as well. And one needs a somewhat different arsenal, a somewhat different quiver of weapons to bring to bear on this. We have alluded to the difficulties of including the subjective coordinates into models. I mean, how does one quantify them? How do you even specify them clearly? I know how to measure a mass or a distance with precision and with unambiguous specifications. Not quite so clear how I measure a purpose or how I measure a value and put a number on it. So there are these issues of specification, quantification, and these in turn roll over into problems of replicability. With systems that are intrinsically uncertain, that have this complementarity intrinsic to them, you cannot expect the experience to play by the same replicability rules. And it's not simply a matter that you now have statistical results rather than deterministic results, although that's a major part of it. But even beyond that, you now have a higher level of uncertainty that's imposed beyond the statistics that give you different statistics in one situation on one day from those you get on another day in another situation. There are two other domains of implication that we ought to talk about before we stop here. The one, of course, is a related one, the implications for the world of technological applications. What can you do with this in practical terms? What are the pragmatic utilizations of this new understanding? First of all, you need to divide between the negative and the positive applications of these things. If indeed human attitudes, human values, human resonance, human purpose, human desire is influencing tangible physical behavior, you now have a problem of insulating delicate information processing systems, control systems, whatever, from this crosstalk with their human operator. That the crew of a high-performance aircraft, or that the attendant staff in an ICBM silo, or that the surgeons in an operating facility, when under periods of stress, when desire and purpose and values and impact, meaning, were running very high, could we guarantee that the technical components of those human-machine systems were going to continue to function nominally, or did we have to take account of the possible disturbances that might avail of this high emotional environment? So you got an insulation problem that you need to worry about. On the positive side, however, it doesn't take much extrapolation to think of attractive applications of these interactions. We've mentioned the field reg systems, for example. Could they not be imagined now as additional components in information providing recipes for business planning, for public safety and national security, for medical diagnosis, for marketing? Here is an independent source of judgment of whether you got a good idea or not, or whether there is a resonance prevailing here, whether there is a collective purpose at work. That's got to be useful in many contexts if properly developed and deployed. But even before that, the analog to our own laboratory-based experiments, where somehow the molecule of the human and the machine, when achieving this resonance, when achieving this self-sacrificial bonding, can produce different outputs. There is more information riding on the output of an REG that has responded to an operator's intention than there is the one that's just running a chance. One can think of useful applications of the fact that that human-machine system can do things better than the human or the machine can alone. Perhaps quite analogous to the sort of transcendent performance one gets from a musician and his instrument, between an athlete and his equipment, between an artist and his palette and paintbrush, between a scientist and his theoretical models, that somehow lurking out there is a possibility of a higher quality, a higher performance bonded system than we have presumed up to this point. The final category, of course, is what the implications of all of this, beyond their implications for science evolution, beyond their implications for technological exploitation, what are their implications for our culture, for human society, for the individual and collective human state?
I think one of the most striking implications is it's scary. On one level, it's very appealing. It somehow calls to some higher part of ourselves, this drawing to some cosmic connectedness, but at the same time, it undermines the validity or the integrity of us as individual systems, our independence, our free will, et cetera. It also calls on us to recognize our responsibility for the reality that we experience. This is something I think a lot of people would just as soon not deal with. And I think that beyond that sense of responsibility, I might add the other thing that gets kind of scary is the acceptance of uncertainty. Particularly in the scientific world. We have, as humans, striven since our earliest development to try to acquire more and better control over our environment, to be able to make predictions, to be able to control factors that hitherto we felt victims of. At the same time, another complementarity, we want to hide our sense of responsibility behind our feeling of, well, I'm a victim, what can I do, I'm only human. I don't want to have to make choices. I'm more comfortable being told what's right and what's wrong. And we see this in our culture on both sides of the fence. These raise situations, I think, of cognitive dissonance within the human psyche, of trying to come to terms with them. Are we capable of taking the responsibility for making our decisions and selecting and influencing the reality we experience? Are we willing to look at the world around us and say, hey, we can do something about it, even if it's just a few bits in 10,000, we can have an impact. Maybe together, if we're all on the same wavelength, we can have a bigger impact. One thing our data have told us, that you can shift the mean of a random distribution significantly by moving only a few bits in 10,000. So this responsibility, this participatory world that opens to us as we contemplate these things is both alluring and is also intimidating. I think this is where we have run into the resistance that we have felt over the years to the work we're doing. You know, it's not that people have been necessarily obnoxious or pejorative or ad hominem, this stuff is nonsense, it's pseudoscience, it can't be demonstrated. I think we have to be a little more compassionate along those lines and say, you know, these people are scared. I have heard people say that, well, if what you're doing is right, then everything I've done is wrong. And you say, no, it's not wrong, it's just not complete. It's surprising how uncomfortable that makes people. I've often enjoyed in my conversations with our younger guests, our elementary school kids, asking the group, how many of you want to be scientists when you grow up? And there's always several hands that go up right away. And I tell them, well, you know, if you want to be a good scientist, there's two things that you have to learn how to say, and they're not easy. One of them is, I don't know. If we aren't willing to concede our uncertainty, our lack of knowledge, we're never going to learn anything new. If we go in thinking we already know everything we need to know, we're not very open to new information. The second thing, which is even tougher, is I was wrong. I can remember one young lady who looked at me in shock and said, oh, Mrs. Dunn, I can't even say that to my brother. It's true. It doesn't come easy to say I was wrong. And yet, if you're going to be exploring a domain that's characterized at least to some degree by uncertainty, you got a pretty good chance of being wrong. And you have to take that chance if you want to learn more about this world and how we relate to it. Things that we take for granted, now we have to question. When I first came to Princeton way back in the very early days, and I was a little intimidated finding myself in this engineering school where people were talking a very strange language and using big words like spectrophotometers, and I couldn't even pronounce the things. It took a while. Like so many people in the face of the scientific authority, you feel a bit intimidated to expose your ignorance. And Bob got me a wonderful little plaque to keep on my desk, which is still there. It says, don't be afraid to ask dumb questions. And this is something we all have to learn. Let's ask dumb questions.
More and more frequently asked question that I encounter is essentially on the basis of this more than a quarter century of intense involvement with this topic. What now is your worldview? What is really the picture? It's a hard question to answer because what is becoming more and more clear is that answer cannot be expressed in traditional terms. The tradition has to change. We've written about this in a couple of our theoretical papers, but just to summarize, my own view at this point is that our world comprises two grand entities. One grand entity is, in a sense, exterior. It is outer. It is a surround. And we've referred to it as a source. And this entity is so grand that we have only, so far as we've evolved, learned to penetrate it only slightly. by our capacities for penetrating this thing, experiencing it, are so limited, so filtered, that we only get into the shallowest layer of this, and out of that comes our experience of our environment, our experience of events. But there is much, much more out there, much deeper, much more profound, that we are not accessing very well at all. This source is complemented, here's that word again, by another grand entity, which we can call consciousness, the mind. I'm not talking about brain function. I'm not talking about neurophysiological grids, except insofar as they are useful to the mind. But this grand entity, this inner entity we call the mind, is also only slightly utilized. We have learned how to write and read and see and hear. We have learned how to think at some level. But behind this, deeper in this grand entity, there are capacities yet to be uncovered that far exceed anything we have enjoyed so far. And our life, our mortal existence, is carried out in this small regime where the front edge of this grand source and the front edge of this grand consciousness interface, and a certain amount of information flows back and forth at conscious levels, at unconscious levels, at what the scientists call epistemic levels and ontic levels. But there's much, much more. And what this program has showed us is a little bit of a preview of coming attractions, of how, if you could get deeper penetration, deeper interpenetration of the grand mind with the grand source, what sorts of wonderful things could indeed be added to our experience package. And if we have contributed in any way to moving that a little bit forward, if we have given any hints how you penetrate more deeply by changing your filters, by applying interdisciplinary metaphoric experience, by accepting uncertainty, by utilizing complementarity as a powerful tool for accessing much more deeply these two regimes, we will be gratified. I think that is where the culture will go, and it certainly will take a lot more work like ours, a lot more resonance, a lot more tolerance, a lot more openness to move this thing forward into the future evolution of the species.
When we started this program back in 1979, the word consciousness was really quite taboo in scientific circles. It's now quite acceptable, even if not everyone who uses it means the same thing by it as we do. We then introduced or started using the word resonance because it seemed like a reasonably sanitary word to use in scientific circles to express something that otherwise was a bit uncomfortable in such company. Consciousness now has come to be associated primarily with, as you say, the cognitive sphere, the conscious, aware, waking mind. And yet there is so much more to our being than just that aware, waking part of our consciousness. It goes far deeper. And there are dimensions of it that go beyond the thinking part of ourselves. There is spirit. There is soul. Words that still remain very taboo. It would be very nice to see the evolution of science move in a direction where, just as we've come to be able to say consciousness, that someday we can shift from using ambiguous terms like resonance to saying love, to talking about spirit, and to recognize that these are part of our world. They are central. They're critical components in our creation of our reality. And if we want a loving, spiritual, dynamic reality, then we would do well to get together and share that vision share that intention and accept those dimensions as well.